This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 38 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we are joined by the lead race announcer for NASCAR coverage on Fox, Mike Joy, ahead of what will be his 45th Daytona 500, working either on radio or television for the race. Mike, thanks so much for taking some time to come on the podcast today. As you prepare for your 45th Daytona 500 broadcast this week, how does the excitement level compare to what it was for your first one, if you could think back to that?
It's really pretty similar. Certainly there is not the questioning of what will we do and how will we do it and how will it come across and will we get it right? But right now there's just as much apprehension given the forecast for this weekend is not stellar. I think they're up to about 90-some% rain for Saturday.
Oh boy.
And Sunday looks better. Not a lot better, but it does look better. But no, Brandon, my favorite race is the next one. And the fact that we get to do this, we don't have to do this, but it's a labor of love. And with a lot of the new tools in our Fox toolbox this year, I'm really excited to get the season started. And yes, it would be nice, as if in other sports you had a bunch of races or a bunch of events to get ready for the biggest show of the year, but this is how NASCAR has always done it. Come right out of the gate, full speed ahead with the biggest race of the year.
Yeah, that's definitely a dynamic that's unique to NASCAR. You grew up in Connecticut. You got your start in motorsports there. The Northeast is not exactly a hotbed for racing that some other parts of the country are. Did you come from a racing family?
No, not really. My dad had quite an interest in cars and attended a race or two. But I remember in my high school years, you know, saying, hey, some friends are going up to Lime Rock for the race, or some friends are going to Riverside Park Saturday night to see the Modifieds. And maybe that's not such a great idea. I don't know. Maybe they were afraid it was like going to see the circus and not coming back, you know, because you joined the circus. I think there was that fear. But in college, I started going to races with there was a sports car club at the university, and then going to modified races and getting involved in racing, and it grew from there. You'd be surprised. When I worked at Stafford Speedway in the northeast corner of Connecticut, we got all of the sports editors of the major metropolitan papers in New England and got them together and said, look, do you realize that on the average summer Saturday night in southern New England, there are more people at racetracks than at any Red Sox game? And they couldn't believe it. And we started showing them the numbers. And yes, these were smaller tracks and with smaller crowds, you know, 3,000 to 6,000. But right, added together, there was huge interest in auto racing. And the daily papers that went after that audience saw circulation increases and advertising increases. And they realized that, much as USA Today did when they came along, that there was an audience for this sport that really thirsted for news. And so it took off pretty well. It's still pretty much a hotbed for racing up there, although it's certainly a minor sport compared to other major leagues.
Right. So what were you doing in Connecticut that kind of got you noticed by the late Ken Squire, who helped bring you to MRN and then later CBS?
I was going to college, and part-time I had a job in a Firestone store busting tires for $3 an hour. Which, when my friends were going, would you like fries with that for $1.50 an hour? I thought I was in really good shape. We were running autocrosses, pylon racing, one car on the track at a time against the clock. And our club would rent the local short track, Riverside Park Speedway, for Sundays to do that. And the track owner came in and watched cars going around. And when I wasn't in my car or working on my car, they said, hey, you're doing college sports for radio. Why don't you go up on the public address and tell people what's going on? Well, Ed Carroll, the feisty Irishman that owned the place, was not happy that people were sitting in the grandstand watching single car time trials and not out spending money in his amusement park. So he hired me to come and work Saturday nights and be the assistant track announcer. And a year later, graduated and became the primary track announcer for $25 a night, which was more money than I had seen in one single day doing anything to that point. Thought this was really pretty good. And for the big events, the big demolition derbies and the big 500-lap team race, they bring Ken Squire down for Vermont to call those races. So that's where he and I first started working together, sharing a microphone and forming a bond.
The 1979 Daytona 500 was one of your first working the event. How important was that race and broadcast for NASCAR?
Well, from the radio side, we had been doing the Daytona 500 since 1970, when Ken formed Motor Racing Network with Roger Bear. And the main thing that drove the formation of the radio network was Bill France Sr.'s youngest son, Jim, who runs the sport now, was in Southeast Asia in the military. And if we had a network, Armed Forces Radio would cover it, the 500, and that was the start of that. But 79 for CBS coming and doing the Daytona 500 was pretty unbelievable. Only once before had a stock car race been carried on network TV live, flag to flag. ABC did it at a short track in South Carolina in the early 1970s. Ken Squire was the pit announcer for that at NASCAR's behest. And it wasn't good. You know, Bobby Isaac finished the race, the only car on the lead lap. It really wasn't competitive. There were a bunch of cars bouncing off the wall and that sort of thing, but it was an experiment that was not repeated for nearly a decade. And then in 1978, Squire convinced Neil Pilsen, his boss at CBS, to sit down with Bill France Jr., who was running NASCAR, and see what kind of deal they could do to put the 500 on network TV. And it was, it really was the perfect storm. All of the East Coast was blanketed in snow that day. People couldn't get out of their houses. Well, what's on TV? Here's cars going fast, you know, on this big track. Let's watch this. And the ratings were good. And at the finish, where the ratings are almost always the best in a NASCAR race, they had a great battle for the lead that came down to Donnie Allison and Cale Yarborough. They crashed on the last lap. And did you know that not only was Ken Squire the motorsports editor and voice of CBS Sports for auto racing, he was also their voice of boxing. So Ken just shifted gears when Donnie and Cale and Bobby Allison got out of their cars. And there's a fight. And went into boxing commentary. And it was just the darndest thing. The ratings were great. The sport took off from there. Cale, Donnie, and Bobby each got fined $5,000 for the fight. Bobby is livid to this day that NASCAR never refunded that fine money, yet they've shown the clips of that finish and the fight over and over and over again all these years since.
What were your what are your memories of broadcasting that race?
I was on a scaffold in turn two. Now, at that time, we did not have wireless communication. It was not perfected to the degree it is now, nowhere close. So we had to use pairs of phone lines to connect our headset and amplifier to the announce booth. It was all wired. Even our pit reporter would work up and down a section of pit road, but he'd be tethered to a terminal. We just didn't have reliable wireless communication. So I'm on a six-story scaffold, and climbing that scaffold was about the hardest thing I ever had to do. First off, the AT&T people had left our connection board, which was pretty good size with equipment, at the base of the scaffold. So I had to get that on my back, along with my notebook and microphone and amplifier. And I had to climb a six-story open scaffold, which is something I never, ever wanted to do before or since. And I got halfway up, and I said, you know, I could probably do okay from right here. And then it was like, what if I miss something? What if a car is behind a camper in the infield and I miss it, you know, spinning or coming to a stop? So I got up to the top. That was the shakiest scaffold in history, I think, but, you know, got the job done. So last lap, the car's going down the back straightaway, and I'm turning. I'm watching Cale and Donnie off in the distance, and Gary Gerald, the great Sacramento Kings announcer, was the turn announcer in turn three. And he goes, oh, my God, they're crashing and sliding and slamming. And I'm watching this all unfold. And they slide up and they hit the banking. They come back down. And Gerald finishes his commentary. And in the tower with Barney Hall, Jack Arut goes, we'll have a new leader. They're in turn two in front of Mike Choi. And I go, yeah. It's Richard Petty. You can hear it in my voice because I was as shocked as anybody. I knew Petty was third, Waltrip was fourth, and AJ Foyt was fifth. But I didn't know how close they were or whether there was a chance for a pass. Because I was watching, along with the rest of America, what had happened up at turn number three. So it was Richard. Darrell's car was on seven cylinders. And a footnote to that finish, AJ Foyt, his spotter that day was Paul Page from ABC because Page was in town to call the IROC race for ABC, the International Race of Champions Friday. And Foyt, who only ran a few NASCAR races then, said, hey, I don't have a spotter for the 500. Why don't you come and spot for me? So Page is spotting, and with 10 laps to go, Foyt says, this thing is pushing like a dump truck. He says, we got a chance to win this thing? And Page says, no, Cale and Donnie, they're a straightaway ahead. You'll never catch them. Foyt says, okay, I'm just going to ride this out because fifth doesn't pay that much less than third. So there went AJ's chance to win his second 500, and he finished third. But, yeah, it was a day that coming out of that race, everybody knew that stock car racing had been taken to a new level by CBS.
Your first Daytona 500 as the play-by-play voice for CBS was also Dale Earnhardt's first time winning the race. You can't really script it much better than that. Where does that moment rank in your career?
It's got to be in the top five. It's pretty high up. And it's not so much for anything that I did or what Dale did. It was our whole CBS team. Greg Fielden was our historian. Patrick Perrin was our researcher, who does the same job for Fox today. And I had them research just every different possibility of what Dale had not accomplished in the 500. And it turned out, I think there were only three numbered laps that he had not led of the 200-lap race. Lap 92, maybe lap 97, and of course, lap 200, the last lap. So in the home stretch, as Earnhardt was leading, you know, we caution viewers, you know, he's been in this spot three times before, and you know, what always happens, even sometimes on the last lap. But I think in the last few laps, all of America was pulling for Dale, and he finally wins the 500. The one thing, he'd won 30-some races at Daytona.
Right.
He'd won everything but. And so he gets the 500, and usually we go right to break because it's going to take a lap, a victory lap, and then come to victory lane. We'll do the ceremony there where Ken Squire was waiting for him in victory lane. And our associate director, Jim Cornell, who's in charge of getting us to commercial on time, he says, don't go to break, Lance Sparrow, our producer. Don't go. Something's happening here. And that's when they formed up that magnificent receiving line all the way down pit road for Dale. And we were able to capture that live. It was just a tremendous team effort of everybody involved.
How was Dale's demeanor at Daytona and all the years losing at the 500 compared to after he finally won and got that weight off of his shoulders?
We'd had a number of really top drivers, Hall of Famers in the sport. Ned Jarrett, for example, that won everything but the Daytona 500. And I think when Dale had the issue of running over the piece of somebody's brake rotor on the last lap and Derek Cope won in 1990, you know, he and Richard Childress, I think they had just both resigned themselves to, you know, we're not supposed to win this thing, but we're going to keep putting ourselves in a position, like Richard Petty always said, best you can do on any given Sunday is put yourself in a position to win, and then circumstances will dictate the outcome. And that's, you know, that's what they did. They built themselves a great car, had great stops, put themselves in a position to win, and it finally came true. So I think his demeanor leading up to it was, oh, yeah, another Daytona 500. And as when after that, of course, you know, everything had changed. I remember one, it wasn't 98, of course, because I was in the booth, but it was either 96 or 97. And I'm standing on pit road with a microphone, and the cars are gridded, and Dale's in his car, and they've done everything but put the window net up because I wanted to talk to him. And he agreed. And he's sitting there, And he knows what the question's going to be. And it's, you know, how many times? And it's, you know, geez, Dale, everything's happened to you. You hit a seagull. You cut a tire. You blow. He knows the question that's coming. So I walked up to the car, knelt down on one knee, and I just go, hey, champ, you feeling racy today? And he laughs, just the biggest laugh. And I got just the best interview out of him, just the best statement out of him, because I didn't do what he expected me to do, what everybody else had done. You know, it was kind of like, hey, are you going to go out there and have some fun? Hell yeah. That was the Dale Earnhardt I remember.
3 years later, it's Fox's first NASCAR Cup points race. You're on the call. And of course, that is the day of the fatal crash for Dale Earnhardt Sr. Was that the hardest day of your career?
It was one of them. It was certainly one of them. We'd been in this position before on radio and on TV of having, I mean, it's Hemingway said, there's only three real sports, you know, where man exposes himself to incredible danger to try to achieve amazing rewards. Mountain climbing, bullfighting, auto racing. We know the risks. We all accept the risks. And every driver out there says, it can't happen to me. And then it happened to Earnhardt. Well, in the moment, we had no confirmation, no information at all from the accident scene or from NASCAR or from the Speedway. They went completely dark on us. We knew something bad had happened. We knew, and I knew from various experiences, that either Earnhardt, on the one hand, could have been superficially injured and had a bleeding wound and knocked unconscious. And we knew, on the other hand, this could be very serious and had to strike a tone that was cautious yet hopeful. Because as our longtime producer Barry Landis always said, at that point, you're working for the family and you're working for the friends of that driver, and you're trying to make this all work and make sense of it all. What I knew in my gut was that here's a driver who at one point flipped down the back straightaway, got out of his car, says, I think it'll run, jumps back in it, gets a push start, comes back to the pits, they tape it up, and he finishes the race. I knew if there was any possible way, Dale Earnhardt would have climbed in the driver's seat of that ambulance himself and driven it to victory lane to congratulate Michael Waltrip winning the race in his car, with Dale Jr. finishing second. So we pretty well assumed the gravity of what was going on, but we had no real information to go by. That made it more difficult to properly frame the moment. And we went off the air with congratulations to Michael Waltrip and prayers for Dale Earnhardt, because that was all we could do. And I think that was the most difficult part of it. And NASCAR, like other sports, like the NFL found out a year or so ago, that they don't have a plan for this. And informing their TV partners is not part of their plan, which is to get through the event and get through the calamity and make the best sense of it as possible. So we're on our own, and we're kind of flying without a net there and trying to do the best we can for the family, the friends, the viewers, and the sport. It is both difficult, painful, and an incredible challenge. And I hope that day we did it well enough.
Yeah. How do you balance those emotions? Because like you said, Michael Waltrip won the race. You have his brother Dale on the broadcast. It's an exciting finish. It's a great storyline. But that uncertainty with Dale Sr., how do you balance that? Do you just trust your gut in that moment?
We all did. Larry McReynolds, Darrell Waltrip, and I. You know, Darrell would go, oh, Mikey's won the race. And then he turns, he goes, gosh, I hope Dale's okay. And during the break, I assured him, okay, we'll wait for word, you know, and hopefully it's positive. But I really think at that point, your ability as a news hawk kicks in, and it's all right, tell the story, get it right. Don't speculate. but let people know what you're seeing, what you're feeling, what you're thinking. But be guarded until you have concrete information. That's what we're trained to do. And then the emotions get to you of what could possibly have happened there and how it could have been caused and who, if anyone, was at fault. And that becomes difficult. You just have to rise above that and stay with the story and help it along as the story develops. It's not fun, but it's a big part of what we have to do sometimes.
Do you know if Dale Jr. was interviewed after the race there on the track, or was he immediately ushered away from any media responsibilities to get an update on his father?
My recollection was that he went to Victory Lane to congratulate Michael, and that someone whispered in his ear and he was ushered away after that. But I'd have to look at the tape to guarantee.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm just curious.
Michael Waltrip, in his book, which I think is titled In the Blink of an Eye, is that right? Yes. Says that Ken Schrader came to Victory Lane. And Michael asked him, how's Dale? Because Michael knew that Dale had crashed. He had been told. And Schrader told him, it's not good. Michael went, okay. And did what he had to do to complete all of his commitments there. But yeah, very, very difficult day. Probably the hardest in motorsports in a long, long time. Because after that, everybody started questioning everything, because they knew if it could happen to Dale, it could happen to anybody.
Right.
In the aftermath of that, we've had tremendous advances in driver safety, in the driver compartment, in NASCAR, which previously left driver safety up to the driver, finally taking a leadership role in the development of safer cars and safer barriers around the racetrack, so that the sport we have today is way, way safer than the sport that Dale raced in.
Kevin Harvick took over Dale's car that season, and it was 3 weeks later that he won his first race. How were the emotions of calling that race and finish?
Well, let me take you up to that race, because first we had Rockingham right after Daytona. And that's a 2.5-hour drive from my house, and for some reason it took 4 or 5 hours. Kept stopping on the way, you know, stop and get a soda. So I didn't want to go there. Nobody wanted to go there. Nobody wanted to be there. But Richard Childress, by putting that white number 29 car out there, showed everybody that this is what he and Dale had talked about. This is what Dale would have wanted. You know, Dale had told him on a hunting trip in Montana. He said, anything ever happens to me, he said, you keep this going. You know, this is too good a thing to let go of if something happens. And they made a pact that each of them would do just that. So here's Kevin Harvick, who had been racing in the Busch Series, now the Xfinity Series, for Richard Childress, and was scheduled anyway to make his debut at Atlanta in a Childress car in the Cup Series. And now he's thrust not only into the series, but into the spotlight. And in Atlanta holds off Jeff Gordon for that big win. And, you know, I think all of us, not just the broadcast team, but all of us, the entire sport, just drew a collective breath and said, okay, it's okay to be back at the racetrack again. It's okay to cheer for something. This doesn't make everything right, but it shows that we're on the right path.
Harvick is now your colleague at Fox, and he has been for a while, but this is the first season where he's going to be in the booth full time. How has it been working with him?
Well, it's the first time he'll call a Cup race. Will be the Daytona 500. It'll be the first time that he has seen the Cup Series on the track at Daytona from the tower and not through the windshield. So certainly it's going to be an acclimation. We've had a lot of meetings. We've done the Clash in Los Angeles. Kevin has a lot of great ideas of how to portray this sport and give the viewer more information about it than they've ever gotten. And yet in a way that's going to be interesting. Darrell Waltrip started off Fox Sports and NASCAR, and Darrell was the greatest entertainer ever to put on a headset and an auto race. Did a fantastic job. Jeff Gordon came in and was, I feel, the best analyst at what the driver was doing and going through and helping with stories about the other drivers and how they prepared and how they were competing and what was on their mind than anybody I've worked with. And I think Harvick is going to be very much in the Gordon mold. He's very factual. He's very matter of fact. And yet he doesn't paint the brush in a whole lot of colors at once. You know, it's going to be pretty frank and very honest. And we've got Clint Bowyer for the entertainment side and to also analyze and also to quiz Harvick, because Kevin Harvick's the first person to do television in NASCAR that has raced the Gen 7 car that we have on track today. Nobody else at Fox or NBC has. So this just been there, just done that at a high level in a position to win kind of experience just can't be bought anywhere else. So that's what I'm really looking forward to.
Have you enjoyed having a rotating cast of analysts, or do you prefer to have a permanent partner in the booth?
It's a challenge. And it's one that Clint and I both welcomed. We've had analysts like Tony Stewart, who came very prepared, who owns a race team, who knows the mechanics of the sport. He's a champion of the sport. He knows a lot of the drivers personally, and he came in there loaded and ready to go. And I think Tony did a great job and could have continued in TV if he'd wanted to. And then we had a couple people who showed up with their hard card and a smile. And they could talk about what they'd done and talk about what they'd seen in the sport from afar since. But let's just say not everybody was a great analyst, but it was exciting to have the opportunity to try them all and see how that worked. And it worked okay. But I think we now have a team we're going to build for the next few years, and we're really excited, all three of us, excited and anxious to get going with it.
Do you feel like you know right away which analyst it's going to work with and which it's not, or does it take time with some analysts to get comfortable and kind of good at their craft?
Well, you pretty well know by the first caution flag in the race whether you have to lead an analyst with questions or whether they're just going to jump right in. And we use a lot of visual cues in the booth, you know, when somebody wants to get in, or, hey, I want next, or whatever. So we got that. You usually know that by about the first caution flag in the race, and you usually know by halfway if somebody is really contributing or if they're reacting. And one way makes your job a lot easier than the other, but that's okay. Again, that's all part of the challenge.
Sure. I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. If the NFL ever moves to an 18 game schedule, it will probably bump the Super Bowl to President's Day weekend, something I think a lot of football fans are clamoring for because they want that Monday after the Super Bowl off. And with NASCAR having the Daytona 500 there, would you be in favor of the Daytona 500 standing pat on the day of the Super Bowl or going back to having the race on that last Sunday in February?
I'm glad I don't have to make that decision. Since 1959, the Daytona 500 has always been on the Sunday before the third Monday in February, I think is the rule. And usually that's now later became President's Weekend.
Yeah.
And it's a great place for it. But we all know that the NFL is, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in sports on television. And everything else is not on that level. So would I want to run the Daytona 500 on the afternoon of the Super Bowl? I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind trying that. And the reason is everybody's home. I had to go out and I had to leave the house and run an errand on Super Bowl Sunday. And the roads, it was like Christmas Day. There was nobody out that didn't have to be. Everybody was home. What are you doing at home? You're waiting for the Super Bowl. Do you really want to watch all those hours of pregame? And a lot of that programming is really good. Or would you rather watch a live, exciting event in progress? Again, I'm glad I don't have to make the decision, but I'd be willing to take the risk. Now, If you get rain delayed till late in the evening, you're sunk,
yeah.
right? In more ways than one.
Yeah.
But I don't know. As you say, we may have to face that in the coming years, and the folks at Fox will figure out how to do it. I guess my hope would be that if it's going to happen, I hope it happens in a year that Fox has the Super Bowl, because then we'd have the biggest doubleheader day in all of sports television, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, that would definitely be incredible. Okay. What is the state of NASCAR on TV? Average viewership is down significantly from what it was, say, a decade ago, but it has rebounded some. Is that something that you concern yourself with at all, or just kind of only focus on controlling what you can control?
Well, it's a bit of a disappointment, because I don't understand how we got from Ricky Bobby and Talladega Nights in 2006 and 2007, and all the political pundits talking about NASCAR dads as a voting block, and how the sport has kind of drifted. You know, I know what some of the triggers were and some of the things that put some people off, but I don't understand this loss of fan base. And then during COVID, NASCAR, as the first sport back in action and the first sport back on television, failed to take advantage of that and get in front of all of the sports shows on TV with a live event that was really happening, instead of what are the Cowboys going to do for quarterback when we can eventually play again. You know, I thought that was disappointing. But we're going to go out there Sunday and try to do a good job in pre-race of building stories about these drivers and why you should care about a particular driver winning the race, and hope you stay with us for the whole 200 laps. Not going to take that long at Daytona, not at 195 miles an hour, and give you the best possible telecast of a race that the 300 people that are on site here can possibly do. And that's our goal. And the ratings on Monday or Tuesday, well, the execs and the salespeople will look at that and figure out what to do next. But as long as we've done our best and we can walk out of that booth saying, you know, I don't think we left anything on the table, I think we had a really good telecast, if we can do that, I'll be very happy, and we'll get on to Atlanta next week.
Yeah, it seems like NASCAR should have a lot of untapped potential still with the audience. Like, if you, I live on Long Island. If you go to any high school on Long Island, I'm sure if you ask kids, do you like cars? Do you like fast cars? Do you like competition? The answer is always going to be yes. But do you sure. like NASCAR? And most kids are going to say no. So there is certainly a new audience to be had.
Yes.
I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot of outreach we can do. Now, yeah. Back when I was in high school, you had Islip Speedway on Saturday nights. You had Freeport Stadium, a quarter mile track running races. You had Riverhead out on the end of the island, which is yep. still in action as a NASCAR modified track. And then you had the sports car track past Riverhead Bridgehampton.
Yeah.
Had a lot of auto racing on Long Island. They used to race at some of the air bases there back in the 1950s. So yeah, the sport has changed. It's evolved. And the kids that are interested in cars, you're right, they're not all interested in NASCAR. And there's a lot, I think, that we can do going forward to get more and more of a younger audience involved. Like most sports, our audience is trending older along with the athletes, and there's work to do.
Do you think NASCAR should do anything or look to do anything to make their races and broadcasts shorter, similarly to the way Major League Baseball did last year? Because like you look at baseball in 2022, the average game was 3 hours and 6 minutes, I think it was. And then they made a lot of changes. Fans like myself, I was against those changes. But then all of a sudden I'm watching the games last year. They're 2 hours and 42 minutes. And I found myself starting to enjoy that shift, perhaps surprisingly. So is there something that NASCAR should look to do the way Major League Baseball did?
There's always the dual ideas of shortening races or shortening the season, trying to get the season to end before the NFL is really in full swing. That now we know is not going to happen for at least 7 years with the new TV deal that begins next year. As far as shortening the races, a lot of them have been shortened. And I could name tracks where 500 milers had become 400 milers, 500 lap race become a 400 lap race. So NASCAR has been kind of moving in that direction. but you still have to have a long enough event to make it worth the ticket buyer's money and for the TV network to get their commercial load in. So I don't think you're going to see any great changes in that area. If you do, it might be with one of the two all-star type events, the all-star race and the season starting clash, where NASCAR can experiment with smaller, shorter formats. But so far, as we moved the clash to Los Angeles and made it, you know, a short kind of a heat races and then feature race format, it really didn't see an uptick. So I think there's more work to be done in building the fan base before we start chasing people's perceived short attention spans.
Sure.
So my goal is to get people into the race and get them involved in watching the race, involved in following a driver to the extent of they want to see where he finishes. And not everybody agrees with that. You know, there are people that, even here at Fox Sports, that say, well, when the winner takes the checkered flag, the race is over. I disagree. You know, if I tuned in and invested 3 hours, I want to see where my guy ends up, not necessarily just the winner. So, yeah, we've got work to do, but I think the sport still has a lot of growth potential.
Yep. Last year, I heard Al Michaels say the start of the Indy 500 was the most exhilarating thing in sports. How does the start of the Daytona 500 compare to that?
Similar but different. There are two racetracks in America where I know the drivers can hear the roar of the crowd. Indy, because the crowd is so huge and it's seated on both sides of that front straightaway. And Bristol, Tennessee, which they call the last great Coliseum because the track is in a bowl, and at the night race, if they fill the place, well, that's 150,000 people in a very, very small area. And so Daytona is different. And the crowd swells beginning in turn four as the pace car gets there. And then the pace car turns into pit road. And it's a huge moment. And in NASCAR, there's probably nothing bigger than the start of the 500. And the anticipation that, okay, you're 200 laps from history. What's going to happen next? Yeah.
What about the Daytona 500 kind of lends itself to unpredictable outcomes?
Wow. History, for one. This used to be a race where you had to be a NASCAR champion to have a car good enough and a car that would last and a car that was fast enough to win. And that's no longer the case. NASCAR, with their rules and specifications, they have put the mechanics and the teams and engine builders in such a box that the speed differential between cars is very small. And the reliability of the cars is very, very high. In the last 3 years, I would venture to say the race has been a lottery. And all you had to be was in the front pack, in position to be able to win it. And then either circumstances, somebody getting out of line, somebody bumping somebody, somebody turning another car, and you see who scoots out from the melee first. Or as last year, who is just in front of it. And even last year's finish was in doubt. Took them a minute or two to figure it out because these cars crashed from Kyle Larson on back, running about fourth or fifth. Was Joey Logano ahead at the moment they threw the caution, or had Ricky Stenhouse passed him before the caution flag waved? So you've had three outlier winners in a row. Michael McDowell, journeyman racer, good road racer, good super speedway racer, but not thought of as a threat to win the 500. He wins it. Austin Cindric, rookie for Penske Racing, in a crash that took out all of his teammates. He happened to be the one in front when the plunger was pushed for the caution light. And last year, Ricky Stenhouse. I don't think that's going to continue. You know, I think the best cars are the best cars, the best drivers, the best drivers. And I'm hoping this year that, you know, we get a name brand winner in the Daytona 500. We get a NASCAR champion, or we get a Denny Hamlin, who's won the race three times but never the championship, and somebody who has a big story that we can build on from Daytona going forward.
Is there one storyline that you're kind of following, as you like, similar to maybe not to the extent of Dale Earnhardt in 1998, but similar to that, where there's something that you're really kind of preparing and clamoring for to see?
I know one driver who is. This is Kyle Busch's 20th Daytona Speed Weeks. Now, he did miss one Daytona 500 because the year before he'd had a horrible crash and broke both his feet in the Saturday race. But it is his 20th try to come down here and win it. And they all want that line in my hip pocket about 20 years of trying, 20 years of frustration, should Kyle Busch win the race. So that's one big storyline. I think technically, the Toyotas and the Fords have new front ends on their car, new nose pieces. That's going to affect them both aerodynamically, and it's going to affect how well they can push other cars, something that Ford has had an advantage in the last few years. And Chevrolet has been at a bit of a disadvantage. Chevy got a new nose last year and ended up winning the race. So I think going in, those are a couple things to win it, a couple things to look at. Excuse me. And more will develop as the week goes on.
Do you have a pick for the race?
No. This is not a race where you can anymore pick a favorite or pick a winner. I want to see a great competitive race, and I want to see a 2 or 3 wide finish. And after everybody crosses the finish line, unlike the last 3 years, and I think 5 out of the last 7, I want to see every driver be able to drive his car onto the lift gate and get it up and into the hauler without having to do any work on it. I don't want to see a big crash at the finish. That's no fun.
Mike, you were great. Enjoy the Daytona 500, and thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Brandon. Thanks for your time. Hope everybody enjoys the 500. 2:30 p.m. Sunday on Fox, with a lot of pre-race coverage on FS1 and on Fox leading up to the race. And if you'd like more on auto racing and on classic cars, my son and I have a YouTube channel called Joy Riding. That's 2 words. And we take different cars for a ride and kind of give our opinions, which being 50 years apart, they're often quite different, but the cars are great fun. So hope you join us there too. Thank you.
Great stuff. That is Mike Joy. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.